My name's Debbie. My background is I've been a lecturer and a teacher working in both further education and higher education. Mostly, I have done some school teaching as well. I've been doing that now for about 16 years. That's my background. That's what I do. I teach politics, I teach sociology and social science, and at the moment I'm teaching critical thinking to undergraduate students and study skills. That's what I'm currently teaching.
Now, there's a lot of criticism of the education system at the moment, Debbie, saying that my generation was being educated in the 19 late 70s, early 80s, was getting a lot more of education in critical thinking, that there's less of it around now. I wonder if you'd agree.
I do agree. I do. What I have seen over the last 15 years of being a teacher, working, like I said, both in higher and further education, is I've seen a descent. I call it a descent in standards of teaching. I'm not blaming the teachers for that either when I say that, because it's something that we are forced to do. Everything revolves around a curriculum, courses and modules that are set. And very rigid, that are all geared towards targets and students passing and grades that we have to always work within those parameters. So what tends to happen is that the more open discussions that I used to have as well as a student, and I graduated in the 90s, in the early 90s, those discussions are rare. We can't always have them with the students. We can't open up those discussions because we will get into trouble. If we try to talk about anything that's too radical, too different, we get into trouble. So I agree with you. I think it has changed. Yeah.
So why is that? I mean, I would have thought that it's quite feasible to build critical thinking into exam grades, to see that students have got a good spread of broad understanding of different views in whatever their discipline is.
Yes, you'd think so, wouldn't you? I mean, topics like, as I just said, I teach politics and I teach social science. Obviously, within a certain parameters of the modules that we're teaching, we do discuss things. Of course, we do. We look at the pros and the cons of different political theories. We look at the evidence for and against. But it's, as I said before, it's in a very controlled way, in the sense that the students are expected to give answers that are set in the curriculum, that are set in the textbooks. And for instance, I mean, if I the only thing I can do is compare it to my experience as a student, which is I'm sure what you were using as your reference point. If I look back to some of my university lecturers, they would stand there and they would, of course they would look at other arguments, but they would tell you what they think about things. They would make a really strong argument to you, one way or the other. They would not sit on the fence. And I thought that was so important, because I think as a student, when you're learning, you need to hear very strong but different viewpoints from different academics and different lecturers. Whereas now, because we are controlled, and that control, actually, I think the difference is that it's corporate now, Tony. When I mean, it was starting to kick in when I was a student, but now I give you an example. The department that I work in, and I work in a well-known university in the Midlands, the department that I work in, all of our courses, all the money comes from a private company. And I'm not going to say the name of the company, because it probably give away too much where I work, and I'd rather not say. But all the management is coming from this private company, and these people are managers. They are business people. They are not teachers. They are not lecturers. They're not specialists in any subjects that we teach, and they are telling us how to teach. They're designing our courses. And just to give you the latest thing that's happened that shows you how bad it is, they have now pre-designed all of our lectures for the semester, so that we just stand there like robots and deliver the lecture that's on the screen. We have no, as lecturers, we have no say in what we deliver. I mean, we can stand there and interpret it and get the students to discuss it. And of course, I will be doing that. and I'll do that to the best I can to open up critical thinking. But we still have to follow this new model that's kicking in. And it's all, to me, it's all taking us towards AI, artificial intelligence, where courses will be delivered on a screen, they'll be preset, and students will learn remotely. And I think
the other thing is that we're moving towards, from what you're describing, a learning situation where you can remove the teacher or the lecturer from the equation completely.
Yes, exactly. And that has started already. I was in doubt as to whether I'd have a job to go back to. I didn't know I was going to have any work or not this semester. And then at the last minute, I had a call from my manager to say, it's okay, the students have enrolled, because of course the big question at the moment for all universities is student numbers. The university I work in relies on international students, as do most universities now in the UK. And our numbers have been, they're down by 40%, I would say, almost between 40 to 50%. The campus is a ghost town. There is nobody in the campus. There's no students there. As lecturers, we can't even really have any contact with each other. It's very controlled. And going back to those student numbers, of course, if we haven't got them coming in from overseas, and of course, you know, who from other countries is going to want to send their children, these young adults, to another country to study when they could be locked down, they could be stuck in accommodation behind a computer. People don't want to do that. There's far too many risks now. So we're losing student numbers. And of course, they're going to get rid of the low-hanging fruit. And that means at first it's going to be part-time lecturers, and that's myself. It's going to be the subjects that they feel are not so financially viable. So all those subjects that I teach, they're going to be the ones that disappear. It's going to be the online courses that are going to take over.
Now, you talked about a private company without going into names and details. I mean, what sort of business is that then? Is, you know, what's its other interests, or is it just a private business that just does university education?
They have lots of contracts with universities around the UK in various departments where they very limited finances as well, because obviously other money comes from other sources, but they fund some of the courses in the university. And they, I think they sell books, they sell learning resources through companies like Amazon. So it's a very commercial outfit. It's not what I'd call educational.
So the idea of, learning for life, you know, the idea of being not necessarily vocational, but just education and learning for the sake of, creative thinking into the future, stretching the human mind, stretching human creativity, doesn't sound like it's got much of a place there.
No, I don't think it has anymore. And that's what's so upsetting, Tony, and so sad. It's if I think back, and I'm sure, I don't know if you went to university, but if I think back to when I was an undergraduate, to me, the main reason I wanted to go to university was to use the phrase, the university of life. I wanted to meet other people. I wanted that experience. I wanted to learn about all sorts of things, not just my subject. I wanted to go through that period when you're quite young of learning, studying in a city. I mean, I did my degree in London, studying in a city, that metropolitan feel, that fusion of different cultures and people that I was learning about, and meeting all these amazing academics and lecturers that could teach me all these different things and open up my mind. Going into the library, and that was something I used to love, you know, spending hours in the library. Now it's all gone. I mean, they can't even, I put a post on social media the other day about this horrific experience I had trying to take a group of students to the library. It was their first week in the UK, some international students, and I wanted to show them the campus because I think it's nice for them to see what's on offer in the university. and took them to the university library, and we were greeted, if that's the word, by a frantic woman wearing a face visor, who demanded that the students have to sign up to track and trace on their phones to go into the library. So I had this, and I was not happy at all, because I felt these students were already registered at the university. They were already on a timetable. So they already knew the students were there, which was why it was so ridiculous. And I questioned this, and I said, look, you know, I'll give you my details and you can look through the university records and you don't need to ask them for track and trace. And in the end, she let me into the library. But then we got into the library and they were trying to force sanitizer on their hands. They asked them not to touch the books because they were going to infect the books. Members of library staff were chasing my students around the library, demanding that they had to put masks on. And I had to step in and say, please, you know, don't question them. There might be disabilities, there might be exemptions. So what was once an amazing experience for a new student, especially in a new country, to come into this, and it's an amazing library, we've got one of the best libraries in the country, to go into this amazing library was an ordeal. It was horrific. And I felt so angry for my students, Tony, that this is what they're paying thousands of pounds for, is to come into this situation. So
okay, so what's life at university like for students now? I understand, obviously, that there's far less international students. I've also heard here anecdotally in Bristol and in Cardiff from students at both of those two universities that there's actually quite a lot less coming from the UK too, because yes. The families have decided actually we don't want the sons and daughters to go to the university because of they may not be able to return to see their parents and this sort of thing. They may not be able to go home. They may be isolated kind of in the university halls and that sort of thing, and they may not be able to leave. So what's the actual conditions like for other aspects of life at your university?
Well, students have been locked down in the halls of residence at the university they're working, which I think is happening in most universities from what I hear, what we've heard in the news. They're being tested. When they started in September, some of the other intake, we all started different times for different courses. But the September intake, they were all tested for COVID, and some of them were tested positive, apparently, and were locked down, quarantined, if you want to call it that, lockdown. And of course, parents have been upset about this. We've had a significant reduction in undergraduate students, new students in their first year. We've got students returning. That doesn't seem to have had so much of an effect, but new students, as I said, it looks like it's about, from what I'm hearing, about at least 40% down on last year. Which is, you know, is terrifying in terms of how
as you're moving around the university, are there any sort of restrictions so that, you know, sort of almost like checkpoints if you're going into certain places? Because I would imagine that they don't want just anybody wandering around willy-nilly.
No, there's lots of members of staff I don't think they've employed new members of staff, but they've redeployed, if that's the word. They've moved other members of staff into these roles where they're checking student ID, checking on masks, and people going around with sanitizer. It's a sanitized environment, Tony. And I walked into the classroom the other day and everything had been so sanitized to the point where I felt physically sick at the smell of all this disinfectant everywhere. So it feels like we're in a hospital. It feels like a medical institution that we're walking into, that you can't touch anything, that you can't walk anywhere. And like I said earlier, you know, the place is dead. It's normally, I mean, I'm sure you know this if you've walked into universities and when you're a student, the place is normally alive with people everywhere. There's a buzz, there's students, there's noise, and you know, there's that kind of that buzz you get from university life. That has all gone. It's all completely quiet. Members of staff policing the corridors. And as you said, you know, there are, I don't know if checkpoints is the word, there are signs up everywhere saying that masks are mandatory, which is something I'm taking up with the principal, because I feel it's been done in a way where students that can't wear a mask feel that they have to, that the signs are very, are very forceful. They don't explain that, you know, to me the sign should also say some people will have exemptions, but it doesn't. It just says masks are mandatory all over the university.
Well, actually, in fact, that's not true. They aren't mandatory, are they?
Well, no, they're not exactly. But it's just, you know, a university which prides itself, it's on its mission statement, it's on the website, as it is with all university, on what they call equal opportunities, recognising disabilities, how it, you know, that it takes this approach makes me really angry for my students. And also we've got the whole cashless thing. The university has gone cashless. They will only take debit and credit cards. And again, another form of discrimination, not only for different people that need to be able to pay in different ways, but in the sense, as I'm sure you know, it's actually, you know, illegal. You have to be able to accept legal tender, which is cash. And again, this is something I'm taking up with the principal. I'm not sure how far I'm going to get, but I have sent an email with my concerns. So
yes, you're right. It is. It's called legal tender for a reason, and that is because you have to accept it as payment. So interesting. But look, I know you're pretty sceptical about these measures, but you're not just sceptical for the sake of it, to be awkward, part of the awkward squad, are you? You've got some, I think, pretty strong ideas, beliefs, evidence, etc. Where would you point us to look at, you know, what you think is actually backing up this policy we've got at the moment, to do with this basic, like a second lockdown, which is spreading across the country, to question it? Well, what is it what concerns have been raised in your mind, Debbie?
In terms of what the reasons for the lockdown, is that what?
Yeah, and why? Yeah. What is it that's prompting you to be asking all these questions and to be saying, well, actually, you know, I disagree with some of the apparent policy decisions that are being made by the university and what they're based on, and questioning the basis of this?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the objections that I have, as with all of this, and I'm also an activist, I've been an activist for a long time, and there's no way at this time in history I couldn't be an activist, I feel far too strongly, is that it's just fundamental basic rights that are being removed from all of us. Not just my students, it isn't just about where I work, it's about everybody. It's about our right to free speech, which is also being closed down. I mean, just those examples I gave you about what it's been like as a teacher for many years, we're restricted in what we can say and what we can talk to with students. I think it's been a long frog in the pan, if you like. I don't know what analogy to use. This has been simmering away for years.
Your reasons that you question this in this whole policy. So, yes. You know, do you have worries about what the government is doing, not just on the civil liberties grounds, but on actual factual things they may have got wrong? Are there things to do with the policy, the evidence behind the policy that, you know, that causes you to be concerned?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I have lots of concerns that I think for me, first of all, my first concern with all this, Tony, was when I first read the Corona Bill, the Corona Act in March, and the fact that on that piece of legislation, it allowed for, I think, not two medical expert opinions to reach the conclusion of death with the coroners. That used to always be the way it was done, and that was changed so it could just be one opinion, and I felt that was of huge concern. So that was my first alarm bell that made me start questioning what was ahead with the virus. And then as the weeks progressed, I think into March and into April, one of the first things that I was alerted to and I checked was the fact that the government had declared, I think Public Health England, NHS England declared that COVID-19 was what they call a non-HCID, a non-highly contagious infectious disease. And when you look at what that means, it means that it's considered sort of low level in terms of the symptoms that people get, in terms of people, the vast majority, if they get infected, would get sort of cold flu mild flu, cold type symptoms. And it said in the statement, you know, there will be groups of people that are far more at risk, such as the elderly, those with serious illnesses that may be more at risk. But for the vast majority of us, we are not at risk of becoming seriously ill or dying. And I think this was also backed up. I think it's on various videos online with Chris Whitty. The chief medical officer actually said this as well. He said it in public, in a public statement. So, you know, these sort of evidence started to come together about the fact that this virus isn't, it's, you know, not enough of a risk for us to lock down the country, to have these lockdowns, to have restrictions on our freedoms and on our liberties. And also, you know, to this, the trajectory, the sort of the move in July towards mandating face masks. This is another thing that I've had real concerns about, is the constantly changing position on wearing a face mask, on wearing a face covering. At the start of all this, you may have seen this as well online, the various ministers, Chris Whitty, and I think even Boris Johnson himself in an interview said that there was no proper scientific evidence for wearing a face covering to, you know, do anything with this virus, and they did not recommend the public wear face coverings. And then, of course, that completely changed in July when they mandated face coverings on, I think it was public transport to start with, and then it moved to shops and indoor spaces. And now we've come back to another position again in the last, I believe, few days, where I believe that the World Health Organization have now turned around again and said that there, you know, there's no evidence that face coverings provide any protection at all. So this is another thing that I have issue with, is these arguments for the risks of the virus, arguments for wearing face coverings. And then, of course, the mortality rate itself. I mean, the mortality rate is, I mean, there's slightly different figures that we're getting. But if you look at Public Health England, I think it's about 0.3% overall at the moment for the UK, which is very, very low. And if we compare these statistics to recent years with seasonal flu, it's not as though this is something of, you know, that's a bigger risk with a bigger mortality rate. So it's those things that I have an issue with, Tony, with the virus. And I think even the World Health Organization have also said something similar in the last few days, that it's the mortality rate on a global scale is not really much different to flu. So it's just not proportionate to me. None of this is proportionate to the lockdown, the restrictions on our rights, and also the fact that our economy is being completely decimated at the moment. It really is. It's going to, you know, the prediction from the Bank of England that we're going back to levels of the 17th century, which is what they said earlier this year, is just astonishing.
With all these restrictions, which, you know, as you're saying there, are very difficult to justify, if not impossible to justify, what do you think's behind this? What's the real motivation for it?
Yes, I feel, this is coming from what I'd call the horse's mouth. If you look, and they're not hiding this, if you look into the World Economic Forum, the World Bank, and you look at their websites, you look at some of the books that they have been producing for the last few years, they are talking about COVID-19 being part of what they call the Great Reset, which is about a completely different economic system they want to bring in, a kind of a reboot, a reset, if you like, of capitalism. And it's a movement towards what I'd call technocracy, a technocratic form of capitalism, where it's, rather than the external world being commercialized and being corporatized, which is what we've been talking about with education, the internal world, and the environment becomes commercialized, it becomes financialized. So different, you know, they're looking, which is what capitalism's all about, isn't it? They're looking for new profit margins, and these are the profit margins that require for them to remove our freedoms and our liberties, because if they want to make money from through the huge pharmaceutical industries, through making profit out of the management of our bodies, then they have to take our rights away to do that, because most people are not going to agree unless there's a very good reason for them to agree, a kind of a fear. And COVID-19 creates so much fear in the population. If there's a fear as to why you're going to agree to give up your rights for this new economy.
Okay, so can you give us an idea of one of these new markets? It's interesting because they are saying that they want to, this is the World Economic Forum, for example, are saying that they want a much fairer economic system. But what you're saying there is really they want the same economic system, but they want to extend their markets into, you know, much more personal things that we think of as sacrosanct, you know, our personal lives. Yes. And our own personal bodies.
Yeah. Well, I think it's worse. I think it's dystopian. I mean, we just have to look at the world when we go out. It's dystopia. You know, you're walking down the road and people are staying apart from each other. People in face visors and masks everywhere. There's pictures online of people at concerts in bubbles, for goodness sake. I mean, it's dystopia. So we can see that this new world, this new normal, as they call it, is worse. It's worse than the awful system we've already been living through. And one of the areas, I mean, there's so many, I think, that they're moving us towards is a different kind of currency. I mean, this is talked about on the World Economic Forum website in the books. They want, as we mentioned earlier with the university, they want a cashless society. There's already countries that are ahead with this on the agenda. They want it all a digital currency. And there are reports, if you read into this, there are people that are pushing for currencies that are linked to our bodies in terms of our movements. The social credit systems often talked about that they use in some Chinese cities where citizens are graded according to their social behaviour, and this is kind of linked to an economy in terms of money and profit. So, you know, this is the new currency they're bringing in, is where we also become the currency as human beings. We're also sort of traded on, if you like, a new kind of slavery. So it's kind of extending it, isn't it, in a new kind of slavery.
Well, that's fascinating because, I mean, you know, a lot of people have been criticising China over the last few years for the internment camps, for the, you know, lack of civil liberties there, and particularly for this social credit system. But it now seems as if there are some people who would, rather than, you know, criticise China for that, would like to bring it in the West. But look, you said earlier about being an activist. And I suppose the obvious thing is, what lessons have you learned from your activism in the past that you think can help us to deal with this today in order to try and keep our civil liberties and not to let this dystopian technocracy take over?
Yeah, we have a huge challenge. We really do. I think we all know that we have a huge challenge ahead of us, because not that it even matters now, but for me, I come from a more left-wing kind of activist background, and something that I always argued for was that people have to stick together, that we need a kind of a movement that sticks together. And of course, we don't really have that kind of, we didn't, that movement in place to fight this. I mean, the left, as we both probably know, is very divided. There's no kind of movement of the working class that's there with the trade unions. So it's not going to come from that. And what I see happening from the groups that are forming in the UK at the moment is it's very kind of broken up, and it's people from all different political backgrounds that don't normally see eye to eye. So this is a struggle for us, because in normal circumstances, we wouldn't even talk to each other, probably. We wouldn't even work with each other. But There are signs there that we can do it, because we all agree that we have to put that to one side. It's about freedoms, it's about liberties, and that we focus on that and put those other things to one side. And what I would say from previous activism is that the way we're going to change this is that if we take what I call a twofold approach. I know everyone has a different idea on what works when it comes to activism. Some people prefer the rallies, the stuff on the streets. Some people prefer a kind of a more micro approach in their communities, where they do things through community groups and activities in their community. I think it has to be both, Tony. I strongly believe it's that both have to come together. We have to get that groundswell of people. We need the numbers. It's a numbers game. If we don't get people out there on the streets, so we have to claim the streets. That's all we have. We have to claim what's ours. So let's claim back our streets and then claim back the rest of it. Let's get out there in numbers. Give people the confidence to do it, because at the moment, people are scared. And I understand that. They're absolutely terrified. We've got a wonderful group forming here where I live. I live in Stroud in Gloucestershire. We've got a wonderful group forming here, but I can see that people are scared of stepping a little bit further and doing things in public. And what I say to people is, get along to the rallies and the demos as a starting point, because it gives you, I don't know if you agree with me, it just, even if it's with people that you don't have to convince, it just gives you this amazing feeling and buzz and energy, and then you can use that and bounce off it to do other things, and then you can take that to do things in your community, set up smaller groups, do things working with your local businesses where you live in your towns. And I think that's the difference with this, what we're facing at the moment. We need to work with the business. We very much need to work with our small businesses, medium-sized businesses in our communities, and link all that up with the community. I don't think we're gonna do this by working in the old ways, the old political ways. I think it's just working in a completely different way.
Well, you seem to be saying that maybe these old differences of left and right. I mean, the left in Britain has always traditionally been the most active. Things like the campaign for nuclear disarmament, trade union movements, things like that. But we've seen, haven't we, in the last few months, that the Labour Party in Parliament has been almost, paralysed or inactive on this issue. And actually, the main challenges to these policies have come from within the Tory Party itself. So, what do you make of this strange change, in a way, between left and right? I can remember actually being over in Germany a few years ago and being so surprised to see the right wing in Germany being very much more active in peaceful direct action, marches, rallies, that sort of thing, than the left was. And so I wonder where you think we're heading with this whole left-right divide.
That's a really good question. It's something I've been milling over for the last 6 months, because I've struggled to get my head around it at first. Went through, it's a little bit like grief, really, as well. If you've been involved with a movement for years, a kind of a process of trying to make sense of it and come to terms with it. One of the things I think I've concluded is that, as much as I've never been a fan of conservatism, and when I say conservatism, I mean that's that ideology in the Tory Party of keeping traditions, keeping things the same. I'm not talking about the economic side of it so much. I'm talking about that, and I think a lot of it is that there's still a strand running through the Tory Party of not wanting to change things, because there's that belief that, the old ways are there for a reason, because they work and people are happy with them. And I think there are some in the Tory Party that see it that way. They don't like to see their country being ripped up, being destroyed, whether it's the tradition of going down the pub, which of course we're seeing pubs being destroyed, or whether it's the tradition of allowing people to go out and protest, even if you don't agree with them. Just those traditions that we have in the UK, and I think they're unhappy with that. And I think, looking at the left, and I say we, I'm not even sure we's the word anymore. That's not the right word, because I'm not even the we. I think the left is not so attached to those ideas, and I think I think the key thing in all this is the relationship with the NHS that the left has. The left has held up the NHS like this jewel in the crown, which, don't get me wrong, of course it's amazing. The NHS has been an amazing thing, but it's not perfect. And it's a huge institution that has been politicised over the years, I feel. And I feel for the left, holding up, you know, the NHS as this jewel in the crown that has to be protected at all costs, you know, the protection of people's health and the workers, you know, I think that has fed into that ideology on the left, a kind of a socialist ideology. And I think people in the movement have been very defensive of any criticism of that kind of ideal, and also of questioning the virus and how it works with that. So I think it's those are two of the reasons that we've got this problem. I mean, I suppose the other thing as well is, I think it was a quote from Winston Churchill. I mean, Churchill once said that the fascists of the future would be the liberals. I think it was something to that extent, something about that it would be the fascists would be the liberals in the future. And I remember when I first read that, I thought, how strange, what a strange quote. But I read it again recently and I thought, actually, maybe he had something there in the sense that I think there's this... sometimes a bit of an obsession with being politically correct on the left, where the left gets so caught up in, you know, being on the right, you know, being quite righteous and virtue signalling, that they struggle to then step back and look at the bigger picture, like what we've been doing this evening in our conversation, looking at what's going on globally, looking at the role of these institutions.
Yeah, it's bizarre is going on the left, definitely, that where you've got this idea that if you're questioning a particular policy, whether it's anti-Semitism or the transgender ideas, that you are somehow a bad person for questioning it, testing it. You are, if you're questioning it, then you are either a transgender denier or a Holocaust denier or something. So that seems to be quite strong on the left, definitely. Anyway, look, what about just to round up? I wonder where you think we might be in a year's time. You know, if things go well, Debbie, and people actually do get together and resist the taking away of their liberties, you know, that they see this kind of China coming over the horizon, this techno world where everyone has to wear a mask, the liberties are gone, we're all profiled and checked in these massive databases, and everybody is either given a green score or a red score or a yellow score or whatever. In a year's time or so, where do you think we could be if things go well?
If things go well, and I'm hopeful, I'm still very hopeful. I still think we're at a fork in the road. I don't think it's over yet. If it goes well, I think actually it will return to very much more localized kind of democracies and developments that are very different in different parts of the country. Because I see, I think it's been happening for a long time. I see the parliamentary model disappearing. I don't think it can last much longer, especially after this. So that's what I see happening. And that's actually quite a positive thing, because I think it could be a return of what I'd call real democracy then, rather than this sham of democracy that we've seen for such a long time. I'm not quite sure how it's going to pan out. I just feel the parliamentary model is over. I think in a strange kind of paradoxical way, the pressures that are coming from global institutions to remove the parliamentary model, which is what I feel is also happening with this global sort of economic takeover, there could be a contradiction there in terms of how we respond as activists and how we change things, where as that kind of collapses, and I think it is collapsing, we have no other way but to take control locally. How we do that is something we'll have to come back to, Tony. We're talking about it here, about how we can do it with all sorts of common law. We're looking into common law and all that kind of stuff. But that's what I hope will happen.
Yeah, I think the reason why that's the solution is because it certainly seems to me, having this week been over to visit the Welsh Parliament and seen the way that power is very much controlled there at the top, you know, the idea really being that the whole of Wales is controlled from Cardiff. The various political parties, the main ones, Plaid Cymru and Labour, are absolutely controlled with, in fact, no discussion even allowed amongst the various elected members of the Parliament about what the policy is going to be. They're just instructed, and the idea is that they're on a career for life, say at Plaid Cymru or whatever. So the top-down model is obviously failing, that control freak model, really, and so something more local has to happen. Anyway, I just wondered if you've got any final thoughts you'd like to add, things we didn't cover.
Final thoughts. Really, I mean, it's just the activism is where it's at for me at the moment. I'm just spending all, loads of us are, I'm not the only one, but, you know, I'm spending all my days trying to do as much as I can to firstly just get people activated and get them out there. And that would be the only thing I would say to people. If you, whatever you can do, even if it's something small, it makes such a huge difference. And I just want to end with an amazing example from something we're doing here in Stroud. Some of us are doing, we're going out into shops and local areas without face coverings. And we did an action, I won't say where, but we did an action in a local supermarket. And some of us just started talking in the aisle without our face covering on. And an older lady walked past with her face covering on. She stopped, she looked at us and she walked on. And then a few minutes later, she ripped her mask off and carried on shopping because she felt, because others were not wearing the face coverings, that she could do it. And it's just something really small, but I think it's those small things that matter as well, not just the big actions, in the sense if we can all just do those things every day, you know, just go out there, try and with confidence, you know, with be assertive, just take the face coverings off, hold your head up high, know you're doing the right thing, because that just holding on to your power over you and your body is key to all this. And That's how simple it is, I think, really. Is
amazing. I mean, we're not getting any of this, of course, from the BBC and the mainstream press. There's not even been advice about how to boost your immune system through things like vitamin D, zinc and vitamin C, things like that. Nothing, even though that seems to be the obvious response to any kind of virus like COVID or the flu or whatever. It's the first thing you do to give yourself a head start if you do catch a virus. So whereabouts do you think, have you got any recommendations of where you can go either in mainstream media, which I think is probably less likely, or online to keep up with what's really going on?
That's a really good point. I mean, as you probably know, I mean, we're getting some really good articles and critical articles from the Daily Telegraph, which I would never have imagined if you'd said that to me a year ago. Daily Telegraph's been very good. Even some of the other more right-wing, if I can use that term still, papers such as even the Daily Mail and the Express. The last week, there's been a complete change in tone. Lots of questions about the virus. So mainstream press is changing, I think, now. Obviously, there are still some papers that are not questioning. I think the Guardian, the Independent are absolutely awful. The BBC is, as you just mentioned, is dreadful. Alternative media, I mean, I look at all sorts because I have an open mind. It doesn't mean to say I'm a fan, but I read all sorts. I sort of been looking at the Lockdown Skeptics website. I look at the, I think Anna Breeze has been doing some really good stuff. Who else? We've got the, my mind's going this evening. UK Column as well. I sometimes watch that. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but just so I can get all this different perspective. Vernon Coleman as well, who's a doctor, an elderly doctor who used to do stuff on TV, I believe. I sometimes check in on what he's saying. So there's lots of sources that you can start reading to get a different perspective. And also, you know, you've got the judicial review that's going through at the moment, and I think Simon Dolan, who is the business, the businessman that's pursuing the judicial review, if you go onto his website, there's lots of information there from his barrister that gives a kind of a legal perspective on all this. That's a good starting point if you're trying to make sense of all this.
Okay, Debbie, thanks very much for joining us.